Welcome to Housing for Huntsvillians, the podcast, a podcast about one couple's quest to eliminate homelessness in Huntsville by August 2026.
Okay. Welcome to the Housing for Huntsvillians podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. This week, we are joined by an amazing guest, John O'Brien. I found out about John through Sue Ann Griffith, who runs the Lily Flag podcast. So any Huntsville history buff should definitely check that one out. Sue Ann said, oh, you guys are working on housing. You need to come to John's talk. And she was absolutely right. So we did. That was last Sunday, I want to say. And I was like, hey, John, amazing talk. Come on the pod. And here you are. So thank you so much.
Yeah, no, it's good to be here. That's a lot to live up to after that intro. So.
You'll exceed expectations. I feel very,
yeehaw,
very sure. So can you tell us, like, did that talk have a thesis, or was it just kind of like, these are some things that I learned about the HHA?
A lot of it was, these are some things that I learned about the HHA.
And that's the Huntsville Housing Authority.
Yeah, Huntsville Housing Authority, and kind of like the history of it as an institution, how it impacted the city. So I'm searching for a thesis, kind of, because there's just so much, right?
Totally.
Like, you start, I wrote my undergrad, like, seminar paper on the Huntsville Housing Authority. I wrote my master's degree on the Huntsville Housing Authority. I've looked at stuff, and every time I go and find a new layer of stuff, I'm just like, oh, everything I knew before was dumb.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I guess there are two competing theses, which is Alabama was actually a critical component of national of urban renewal and public housing policy nationwide. Like, people from Alabama helped to mold it from its inception, even in the midst of the Great Depression up through like 74 and like the Nixon administration cutting a lot of funding. And the second one is that the Huntsville Housing Authority in particular really crafted a lot of the narratives around various communities that were then removed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. So like Boogertown, Honey Hole, there were some communities that were definitely organic and natural that people referred to or talked about prior to the Housing Authority's existence. Mm-hmm. But there were two big ones that became kind of like the symbols of urban renewal in Huntsville. And I don't really think people referred to them by those names prior to maybe county and health department officials being like, oh yeah, that's Boogertown over there.
Mm.
Yeah. So yeah, a lot of competing. Anyways.
Totally. Thank you.
Yeah.
And just for people who aren't familiar, like, what is the Huntsville Housing Authority?
So the Huntsville Housing Authority runs currently our public housing in the city, but has historically been an arbiter between the city and the federal government. And the earliest Housing Authority commissioners were responsible for getting a lot of federal funding for urban renewal projects. And what I've been seeing is the Housing Authority commissioners were also the hospital commissioners and on the airport authority and on the library board. And so it's just this really tight group of a very few individuals that basically from World War II up through the late 60s, early 70s designed the city that we see today.
I thought it was super interesting how you noticed that. So there are only like 5 to like 10 people, mm-hmm, in the first like 30 years,
right,
of the HHA. They were all white men. They were all in business of some kind. A bunch of them were like Kiwanis. Two of them went to the same church. There was just a lot of like social overlap.
Mm-hmm.
And then you noticed how one of them at least owned a furniture store. So if you build a lot of housing, people are going to need furniture.
Right.
If you work for a hospital, it's obviously useful for your employees to have a place to live.
Right.
The cheaper, the better, so you don't have to pay them as much. And it's so interesting. I don't know. We've been really paying attention to the whole public housing situation here, obviously. And I went to a presentation a few weeks ago, and it was sponsored by Huntsville Hospital, and it was all about how we need workforce housing and how the federal government should pay for it. The more things change.
Right. No, they're just hitting all the classic high notes there.
Yeah, totally.
These guys were all involved in the same social circles when they were young men, right? So they were all in the same social clubs. They became very successful businessmen. And when in 1941, when the city was like, hey, we are going to have a housing authority, the mayor's not going to just, you know, pick some randos and be like, y'all are the housing authority now. He's going to go with guys he knows and people that he thinks are successful. And so it was just these handful of dudes. And yeah, like a lot of them were housing authority commissioners until they died. So it was just like a lifetime appointment at that point almost.
Yeah.
Now, of course, you know, I'm not saying the current housing authority board is like that, or that the any of the current that we have in Huntsville other boards are lifetime appointments, but yeah.
Something done.
Yeah.
To think about. Yeah. I mean, I think even today, when you look at the composition of, like, you know, the planning commission or whatever, you see a lot of people, architects and real estate people. And in a way that makes sense, of course, you'd want someone who has expertise in, building and planning, but then you don't want just industry represented.
Right. Yeah. You would want, there should be people who are renters in the city on a planning committee, right?
Right.
Like, that just makes sense.
Right. Ideally representative to what percentage of the population rents.
Exactly.
So why is so much, I feel like, I mean, we were talking about this a little bit before we got started, but housing has started to kind of become sexy.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like you've been focused on the Huntsville Housing Authority, which is kind of the least sexy of the housing, for a long time. What got you interested in it? Why do you think it's important?
Well, what got me interested in it was I needed a topic in like 2007 for my undergrad seminar, and my advisor kept being like, I don't know, that sounds weird and dumb. Don't do that. And so finally, I'm like going through the archives and I find this giant box, and it's just full of all these newspaper clippings about the housing authority. And I see a little booklet in there, and it's made by the housing authority. You know, they put out a lot of their own kind of like press and materials. And it's talking about, like, this is all the things we've done. And, you know, it's the VBC, right? Like the Von Braun Center, Big Spring Park, all of downtown, and all of this. And even outside of the downtown area, obviously, with like the public housing units. And I was just like, oh, this is Huntsville, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is the core city. These guys designed it.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start digging. And it's been just digging since.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I did it in my undergrad, I had to copy by hand. They wouldn't let me scan any of the books, any of the Housing Authority minute books. And so I was just in there like all day, every day. Like,
that's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, this latest round, they let me just go in and take a bunch of photos, which was very cool. I appreciated that. But, yeah.
Yeah. I think if you ask the average person, like, why does Huntsville look the way it does? Nobody would say the Huntsville Housing Authority.
Right. And then it's just all of these, I mean, we got just a stream of urban renewal dollars. And John Sparkman, who was an essential part of housing and urban renewal policy nationwide, was from North Alabama and was good friends with all these guys. And, you know, like in 1942, they were writing them when he was like still just a member of the House of Representatives. And they're like, hey, man, we need to buy some fridges and we can't. And so it's just it's a very early relationship and a very long lasting one. And it was just.
And Stiegel as well, right?
Yeah. Well, so yeah, Henry Stiegel.
Stiegel.
Or Stiegel or whatever, in 1937, you know, he's the chair of the banking committee, and basically.
And he's from Alabama.
Yeah. Yeah. He's from South Alabama, and he held up the first federal housing bill until all of the things that he wanted were in there. So even stuff we're dealing with now, like one-to-one replacement, right? Like that's from here.
That's like, so funny. Yo, I wanted to talk about that actually, the one-to-one.
Yeah.
Let me look it up. Yeah. Congressman Alabamian Henry Stiegel, Wagner-Stiegel Housing Act of 1937, which created the United States Housing Authority, which allowed federal funds to flow to local housing authorities.
Right.
And Stiegel initially opposed public housing because he thought it was socialist and favored urban areas. FDR compromised by focusing on rural and suburban areas, offering local control on how the funds were deployed, and implementing a one-to-one ratio limit. So this is, for every house, one house torn down, they would build one apartment, but no more.
Right. And I mean, so you see this like very early on, all of these guys are worried about the market. They don't think the federal government should get into competing directly with the rental market or with like landlords. But Albert Raines in the Alabama Municipal Journal in like 1955 or something brings up like, if we're committed to the market and there's a whole class of people that can never get on the property ladder, right? Well, then it's our job to make sure that they have comfortable housing so that we're not forcing landlords to like sell and rent at below market rates. And it was really interesting kind of like logic there.
It's the logic that we still have in place.
Right.
Where we can't square the circle of housing is a vehicle for wealth generation. And people need to be able to afford housing.
Right.
Those two things can't coexist. And so we keep housing prices artificially high and then subsidize it at the bottom for a tiny percentage of the people who need the subsidies, and then just don't have anything for people in the middle. And it's like,
it's wild.
It's wild. And that's just the logic. We're just like, yep, that's how we do things.
I mean, absolutely. And obviously in the 50s and 60s, we only had a third of the population, like nationwide, that we do now. And there was this idea of, oh, we can continue just doing suburban sprawl for forever. But I mean, you can't. You run out of room, you get to the point where people have these like insane commutes. And so it's just where we're at now requires us to rethink a lot of stuff, right?
Like, I would hope.
I mean, God, I hope so. Yeah. Like, it's ridiculous.
And it's so interesting to me that it doesn't make any sense. Like, you look at a place like Vienna, for example, and people are like, oh, public housing, you know, Vienna.
It's like 60% of the housing stock, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And no one's getting rich off the remaining 40%. Because in Vienna, housing is not a wealth generation vehicle. It's a place to live. And you cannot afford to do public housing and have housing be artificially expensive to where it's a wealth generation vehicle. We literally just can't afford to do that.
No, and there's the Madison Pike 9th Avenue project, which was the Boogertown project, right? And I was looking at how much money they spent in, you know, 1958 or whatever on it. And it's, you know, $600,000-something, which is about somewhere between $5 to $7 million nowadays, depending on how you calculate the inflation. And they're still housing, you know, like hundreds of people at something that we can't even compete with now. Like if I told you, hey, I need you to house 300 people and I'm going to give you $5 million, like you wouldn't be able to build those units nowadays. So just like the cost of everything is so much further. And I mean, we were building bricks on site. Like there was a whole brick industry in Madison County that sprung up to service these housing projects. And we just don't have that. We don't have like infrastructure in place for like incredibly cheap, fast housing.
I think we don't have the infrastructure in place, but I do think it's more of a policy issue than a technology issue.
Oh yeah. No, absolutely. Like we have prefab, we have all of this.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's up, Kat?
I don't know. I think it's interesting that, yeah, they wanted to, they knew if they flooded the market with subsidized housing, the average housing prices would go down. So yeah, that's
supply and demand.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was the purpose of the one-to-one. I also think it's interesting, like, why are we in this situation where we're focusing so much of our middle class wealth creation and savings vehicles and our and land appreciation? And I mean, what I've heard, and I don't have a better explanation, is that it was an anti-communist measure.
So the most that I know about that is there was a gentleman named Walter B. Mills who was one of the early technical directors for the Huntsville Housing Authority and actually went on to lead the Gadsden Authority. And like, he was all over North Alabama and he was like, yeah, we'd have to have public housing to fight communism.
Hmm.
Yeah. But, and he was, it was the same thing that Albert Raines was saying. Like, we're just going to have just enough for like the lower classes so that they won't go, you know what, Karl Marx. And,
oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about it more from the perspective of like, why have we pushed home ownership so strongly in the United States and pushed home ownership as a vehicle for wealth generation?
Mm.
And the idea is that, I think this was something in the color of law, and it was, you know, just a very short portion, but it was essentially that the federal government was thinking that if people were bought into a system of private property,
right,
and land ownership, that is, would be like an anti-communist measure, which again, like, I don't have good evidence for or against that, but it's really one of the few things that makes sense because it's a terrible way to build wealth.
Otherwise, yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know. Just, I thought that was interesting. You had mentioned before we started recording about what people, like, there's a mythology around what Huntsville used to be and its history and its story and what you found. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So prior to the introduction of Redstone Arsenal and the missile programs and, you know, NASA moving down here and most PhDs per capita, all that jazz. There's this idea that like Huntsville was this kind of like poor backwards place, which, I mean, it wasn't. I mean, it definitely like has its ups and downs. Any municipality is going to, but you know, Huntsville was one of the first cities in the state of Alabama. It was the first state capital. We wrote the Constitution here, or like people in the 19th century did. And then it was the largest like industrial center during the cotton mill expansion.
Hmm.
Like, and it's always been kind of referred to as like the capital of North Alabama, even in like the 1870s, 1880s. And so it's just like,
what do you attribute that to?
What do I, so prior to us building a handful of bridges across the Tennessee River, it was very difficult to get across the Tennessee River. Well, not very difficult, but it took time. You had to get on a ferry, right? And so I think there's just kind of like, and Huntsville was on rail lines. So it's just, and it was a banking center. So I think it's just kind of like early mover, right?
Well-placed agglomeration.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was here first, or here early. And
what are some, you said you wrote a few theses on the HHA. What are some like theses that you've realized were silly or that things you've changed your mind on? If you want to talk about it.
Gosh. Well, I'm just, early on, I was like, oh, this is like super conspiratorial or something, right? But it's not really a conspiracy if you just do everything out in the open. They're like, this is why we're like it. When you have like a small group of men and they're making all of these major decisions, this, that, and the other, you know, you assume like a smoke-filled room, like people with brandy and cigars, like that kind of vibe. Yeah. But they're like, hey, no, this is exactly what we would like to do, which means create a progressive middle class metropolis where there is no poverty, either because we somehow managed to like just change the ideology of the poor so that they lifted themselves up, which obviously like doesn't people need resources and help and right. stuff in order to, or like opportunity in order to, or because they just removed all of the poor people. And so like they were very upfront, and it's a longstanding, like you see these guys, the early commissioners, you know, even in the 1920s when they're young men joining all of these like the City Beautiful Movement Club in the city, all of these organizations where they're like their favorite word is progress. And so it's just like fundamentally ideological is a thing that I've like kind of glommed onto, and not as much like scheming. It's just like they if you grew up in Huntsville in this time period, there was no other way to think.
Totally.
Yeah.
I love that. I think often if you just sit down and shut up, people will tell you what they're doing.
Right.
And they usually think that it's the right thing to do.
Very few people wake up and say, I'm so glad I'm the villain.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I want you to talk about, a question and then explanation. Is redevelopment and urban renewal, are those synonymous or are those different things?
Do you just like urban redevelopment, or what do you?
So sometimes I hear redevelopment, mm-hmm. just redevelopment, or an urban renewal, mm-hmm. seemingly used interchangeably.
Yeah. I mean, as long as it's, you know, the money's coming from the federal government and they used the formulas that were passed after the Housing Act of 1954, then yeah, it's the same thing.
Okay, awesome. That aside, can you define and talk about what urban renewal / redevelopment was?
So you go and you say, hey, this is a distressed area.
So the you in this instance would be like a housing authority?
Yeah, I apologize. It's not... I can't just go, hey, this is a distressed area, give me, you know, millions of dollars to fix it.
I mean, unless you're in the Kiwanis with the guys.
So, yeah, the housing authority or a local municipality, and it really, like, it was up to the states on what they were going to do or how they were going to implement it. Like, New York had a state planning board that interfaced a lot with different housing authorities. Alabama, I believe, when we... in 1940 or so, when the state said, hey, we can have housing authorities now, they were like, I don't know, y'all do it. And so, yeah, your local housing authority puts together basically a case to the federal government, and the federal government goes either yes or no. And if you have more than 50,000 people, they cover 2/3 of the cost, which is pretty good. And you go into the project area, you acquire the properties. It often requires people to move. You can give people loans to refurbish their homes. So there are examples of people living in like a project area for urban renewal and getting to stay there, right? But otherwise, at least half of the area has to be used for residential. The rest can be redeveloped. So you would basically, you take it and you sell it to, you pay market rate, and then you sell it at an enhanced price to car dealerships, who are pretty popular down here. Just whoever wants to move in and set up business.
And this targeted what they would call like blighted areas, what they would call slums, which were low income, disproportionately non-white residential areas.
Yeah. So like nationwide, 60% of the people that were removed during public housing and urban renewal efforts are like Black and brown. Mm-hmm. And 40% are, of course, you know, poor whites. Like mm-hmm. you're not going into many middle class neighborhoods and kicking people out because those people are... they have more political power and say available to them. So even if there is like a somewhat blighted area in there, you're not. And when I say like a blighted area, it's not like every single house in there was bad. There's an urban renewal historian, David Hochfelder, who talks about, and he does a lot of work in New York, and I've talked to him a little bit about the stuff in Alabama, and he's like, that's very exciting. But you know, it could be just a third of the houses in the project area were, you know, unfit for human habitation or severely dilapidated. But all the houses in that project area were now going to probably be acquired or forced to do repairs, stuff like that.
And the public housing in this era, well, in the era of the early HHA, was explicitly racially segregated.
Yeah.
So there were white developments and black developments.
Yes. Yeah. So they tended to do them in pairs. And so you would have like Benford Court and Redstone Park. Redstone Park was the white development. Benford Court was the black development. And then you had Butler Terrace and Council Courts at the same time. And then, of course, you had the Madison Pike, West Avenue, Madison Pike, 9th Avenue, and the Winston Street area at the same time.
And when did that stop happening?
When we stopped getting as much federal funding in the 70s.
Yeah. Okay. So the urban renewal was also very part of a situation where the federal government was helping to fund racial residential segregation.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, in 68, you get the National Housing Act of 1968, which basically like outlaws that and is like, hey, we're all going to live in like integrated public housing units. But the federal government stopped tracking racial data in its housing in 1966. So, yeah, yeah. And so even the counts that we do have where it's like 60% black and brown are incomplete. Right. I don't want it to sound like these are the hardest, fastest numbers that have ever existed. These are best guess.
I think it's interesting that blight is the name for the word that is often used to justify. What did James Baldwin say? Urban renewal is Negro removal.
There's a photo of Von Bronde where there are protesters in the background that have that exact phrasing on a poster. It's in the Images of America series book for Huntsville. I found it when they were working on it, like in the archives, and I was like, y'all gotta put this in here. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So now we're talking about the Mill Creek development.
Okay.
And they're talking about using TIF financing for this project, tax increment financing, using a TIF. Well, when you look at what TIFs are used for, guess what word comes up? Blight.
Yeah.
Just interesting.
I mean, the idea of an area and the people in it being inherently like diseased or unsanitary for a lot of the project areas, you know, it's a story that goes back a century, right? Like, the Mill Creek project area used to be Butler Terrace, and that used to be Broglin Town or Brogtown. And, you know, they were running like sanitary carts through there, right? Because they didn't have sewage. So they would have to like pump out all of the human waste, put it on a cart, run it somewhere to get disposed of. And so, yeah, people in the 1920s were like, this is a blight. This is not a great place. And so you have like a century of kind of like middle-class concerns governing the same space. It's really fascinating.
It's fascinating how cities across the country will co-locate black and brown families and the most polluted areas.
Yeah, environmental racism and whatnot.
Environmental racism. You know, you've got extra levels of lead poisoning. You've got sewage problems. You've got all of the detritus of urban life right next to black and brown families. And then you're going to say, why aren't you performing as well in school?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're literally lead poisoning our children. Why aren't you maintaining your houses as well? Well, you're literally like not providing me the same infrastructure for waste removal as the white families. Well, why do your houses, you know, not look as nice? Well, I'm having to pay way more for my home loan than the white family for the same housing. So literally a larger percentage of my income has to go to paying back this mortgage than a white family, which means I can't spend it on maintaining the property.
Yeah. No, it's a big old cycle.
And then, well, how do we justify further racial residential segregation? Well, their neighborhoods are gross.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of like sorting out theory?
No, I don't, maybe not.
So there's this book by a guy named Thomas Hanchett called Sorting Out the New South City.
Mm.
And in it, he traces the urban history of Charlotte, North Carolina, and it broadly tracks for every major southeastern city.
Okay.
So right in Reconstruction, right, it's like 1870s, 1880s, you have what are called salt and pepper cities.
Mm-hmm.
And this is people from all economic and racial backgrounds are kind of like living eyeball to elbow. And, you know, you see it in Huntsville. You know, there'll be a former governor living on the same street as like a very impoverished, like black family.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yep, let me just, sorry, I hit that. And so there's this like, there's a very slow process where you start getting like zoning laws and you start getting, people start organizing around the idea of like perfecting the city.
Mm.
And so you move from a salt and pepper city to a quilt city is what they called it.
Mm.
And so you might start getting like a middle class black neighborhood is right next to a middle class white neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
you know, like same street even.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the torrent of federal money that came with the New Deal and World War II spending and the growth of the automobile, you get sorted out cities where there's like very distinct sectors and the sectors are usually governed by how close they are to downtown.
Mm.
And so, I mean, yeah, that's how you get like, that's a poor black neighborhood and it's way yonder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a poor white neighborhood, also way yonder, other side of the city. And then here's the affluent whites near the core. And yeah.
That is so interesting. I will definitely have to check that out.
Yeah. And it works for almost every ward of Huntsville. Like if you just go and like pick different censuses and look at it, you're just like, oh, well, dang. So yeah.
That's so interesting. It's something that I really like about Alabama is once you get out of the city, you will see a McMansion next to a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And in San Francisco, for example, like that's not the case at all.
Not a possibility.
It's not possible. I like that Alabama, or at least Huntsville, is way more racially integrated than San Francisco, which is so interesting. San Francisco, I learned about redevelopment living in San Francisco, and you know, it's the reason why San Francisco is like 10% black or something ridiculous. Just like they just totally got rid of their black population by raising all of the black neighborhoods and they all moved to Oakland or elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Brogdown, right? Like the first community that was there and that was displaced for Butler Terrace, a lot of them moved back in, but a lot of them, because it was like a semi-mixed community, so there were like white and black people living in there.
Oh, wow.
And you saw that in a lot of these, right? Like the idea, I think we have this idea of like the early days of segregation, of being like, oh, well, then naturally everyone was far away from each other. And it's like, no, they were still very close. And, you know, and I think that's part of why segregation became such a cultural force, is because people were still living close together. And you had just like this constant, like, if you're like a racist and classist individual, you have a constant reminder, like around the corner, of these people that you find disgusting. And so you want to start moving them away further and further. But a lot of the people that were in Brocktown and Boogertown ended up moving out to the country, like even out to Madison, which is interesting because I live out there now. So
that is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how there's this idea that everyone was like equally invested in racial segregation. But like, for example, with the railroads didn't want racial segregation. They thought it was a pain and it cost them money. It was the federal government that said, no, you have to be racially segregated.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably similar where, you know, where is the profit motive for residential racial segregation? Well, it seems like the main profit motive would be, how do we, again, make sure a certain class of homeowner sees an appreciation in their property values? And how do we, as a federal government, back the loans that are going to be profitable for us, and make sure that the other loans that we're not backing are going to be profitable for the lenders, but through making them very usurious to the non-white families that are having to take advantage of those loans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so like the very early development of West Huntsville, which is where I mostly have focused, I mean, they wanted it to be this like industrial and residential area. And so it is interesting because it's not until like the 1910s and 1920s when you get a lot of outside speculators, especially from like Indiana, which I thought was weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like a guy named Vernon C. Hastings. He's like a lawyer in Indiana, bought up a bunch of land all over Huntsville. Mm. I don't know. But it's then that you start seeing the African race clauses enter the deeds, where they're like, you're not allowed to sell.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's not even until, it's not in like the 1870s that they did it. It's, you know, the 1910s.
Huh.
Yeah.
What happened? What do you think is behind that?
I think because in the 1870s, because it was a mill district, right? There may have just been an unspoken assumption that you're going to be hiring like poor whites from East Tennessee
mm-hmm.
to work in these mills.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, there hadn't been a lot of the sorting out yet. And so you still had everybody living next to each other.
So it's kind of like once the sorting started, then he wanted to codify it.
Yeah. Then you would want it like codified. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate your expertise and your interest. And this is one of those where I'm going to go back and listen to it, even though it's painful for me to hear my own voice, because there are so many things that you mentioned where I'm like, I got to look that up. I got to read that. So that's been amazing.
Very cool.
Is there anything else you'd want us to know about, like, why this stuff is important to know?
So why, I mean, yeah, absolutely. Right. So if we go and we say, hey, everyone has to have like a single family home or something in the city, and it has to be this amount of square feet for the lot. And I think it's on average around like 6,000 in Huntsville. Right.
I should know that.
But if you look at the history, like, people had much smaller lot sizes historically. And I was looking at the the zoning map of the city to like get ready for this interview and whatnot. And we have all of our historic district zoning, those lots are much smaller. And so it's not like what we're proponents for here is a new concept. It's like this is the way people were doing things back in the day, and it's only in the past 70 years that we've been like, oh, your house has to be 2,500 square feet and you can only use this percentage of the lot, things like that. And so it's good to know that these things are new and maybe not as intrinsic to the urban fabric of our city as we like to, as some people present it as.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, one thing I really enjoy about the Lily Flag podcast is that Sue Ann will go through and, you know, if you follow her on Instagram, she's got photos of row houses and streetcars and, you know, a dense, thriving, integrated, you know, mixed use, mixed income, mixed race city.
Yeah.
And that's historic Huntsville.
That's what we were.
And to take what was essentially the zenith of housing racism in the 1960s, which is when our first zoning ordinance passed, and to preserve that in amber and say, that's Huntsville, that's what we want to codify and preserve, is absurd. Like, no.
Yeah. And yeah, to say anything has to, when I was looking at that map, I usually give historic neighborhoods a lot of guff because I'm against, like, how do you say this was the most historic moment of that neighborhood ever, right?
Thank you.
But looking at them and the fact that, you know, I think the smallest lot size you're allowed to have in the city is in the Lincoln Mill Historic District, and it's 4,400 square feet for the lot. And I'm like, okay, well, that's cool. We should preserve that because it would probably get, you know, bought up and redeveloped, and they'd have to do it at 6,000 square feet now. So it made me rethink just looking at the zoning map. But I would love to see, like, missing middle housing. Everyone always talks about, like, gentle density. And, I mean, when we say, like, gentle density, like, Fayetteville, Arkansas was the first town to, like, really do it. It's not, this is not, like, some wild, you know, coastal conspiracy. This is, like, Fayetteville, Arkansas, Montana is, like, having duplexes statewide. And so there are, like, red state precursors.
Sure.
And if you're talking to someone around here, you know, you got to give them a little bit of red meat.
Know your audience.
Yeah.
No, I think gentle density makes sense. I think smaller lot sizes make sense. I think that it's interesting when you talk to people about, like, what is, you know, why we can't have smaller lot sizes. And it's like, oh, well, the drainage is a problem. And it's like, I don't know, man. It seems like that's a solvable problem.
We might be able to figure that one out.
I don't know. Yeah. We put a man on the moon, you know? I think we could figure out what to do with water runoff. But no, I think people are scared of change.
Yeah.
But again, it's like, change is how we got here, and it was for the worse. So maybe we can go back, figure out what we figured out 100 years ago. But anyway, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for your work. And where should people, like, follow your stuff?
They shouldn't. No. there's a Huntsvillean Facebook group, what I very rarely post. I'm working on doing...
And Huntsvillean is your blog.
Yeah. I'm working on doing some more stuff with this first, and... get a little better narrative together. Mm-hmm. Be like, hey, y'all, look at this.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. That's awesome. And you were saying that you were looking for help on some things at the presentation.
Well, I mean, look, it's a big topic, right? It's a big topic. It stretches decades. It's complex. There's a lot of moving parts, and it's all over the city. And I'm not the only person that lives in Huntsville. Like, there are other people here. There are other historians here. And I think, you know, it's something that's, like, worthy of everyone taking a gander at who's interested in housing policy, especially as, like, the history of housing in the city, right? Like, one of the things, you know, talking about narratives, there's a narrative where housing policy is almost received nationally from places like New York and Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, it was being forged right here in, you know, the heart of the Rocket City. Like we were coming up with stuff. And then we were telling the guy who runs the committee that decides all the urban renewal things. Like, so just, yeah, Huntsville's a weird special place for a lot of not always the best reasons.
I think that it's so, like, that was one of the most interesting parts of the talk for me in terms of, like, totally new stuff was how influential Huntsville was. I think you had a stat that was, like, California had, like, 18 housing authorities and we had, like, 136 or something crazy like that. I'm misrepresenting the numbers, but it was a wild difference. And, yeah, just the, I mean, you brought the receipts in terms of how influential Huntsville was in national housing policy. And I truly believe that all of the conversation, 90% of the conversation nationally and internationally, when you talk about American housing policy, focuses on like San Francisco, New York, Seattle.
Right.
But Huntsville represents a much bigger portion of the U.S. population than those cities.
Yeah.
And a much, there's a lot more land that looks like Huntsville than looks like those cities. And so when, not if, but when we solve the housing crisis and homelessness crisis in Huntsville, what we learn about how to do that is going to be so much more powerful in a lot of ways than what they're learning about how to do it in those larger cities.
Yeah, I mean, there's one Silicon Valley. There's a bunch of, you know, federal cities with research parks.
Totally. Right? Totally.
Like, yeah. But so, yeah, like you're absolutely right. We figure it out here. That's something that's replicatable and like immediately has value for all of these like second tier, totally, kind of like less than 300,000 cities nationwide.
And we have to atone for our sins. We've exported some bad ideas. So it's time to export some good ones.
I think so.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on again, and we look forward to our next conversation.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Thank you for tuning in to Housing for Huntsvillians. This podcast is a project of Huntsville New Liberals. Sign up for our newsletter and RSVP to our monthly happy hour at huntsvillenewliberals.com.